This podcast is intended for healthcare professionals only. Welcome to the Oncology Knowledge into Practice podcast, where we discuss game-changing topics in clinical oncology with leading experts in the field. In this series, we're focusing on the ever-changing treatment landscape for cancers of the hematological system. This series is supported by educational grants from Servier Pharmaceuticals LLC and Takeda, who have had no influence on the content or choice of faculty. We're your hosts, Hannah Wilgar
and Andre Grasser. In this special episode, we're going to be talking about the ASCO and EHA conferences, which were both held online this month with many interesting posters and presentations in the field of hemato-oncology. To share their conference highlights, we've invited our ALL expert, Dr. Dieter Holzer, who's the Director of Internal Medicine at the University of Frankfurt in Germany, and our MDS and AML expert, Dr. Amer Zeidan, who is the Associate Professor of Internal Medicine at the Yale University School of Medicine in the US.
So welcome, Dr. Holzer and Dr. Zeidan. Thank you both so much for joining us today. So I'll start with Dr. Holzer. What has been your highlight from ASCO and EHA, thinking about impact on clinical practice?
I think the highlight on both is that we in acute lymphoblastic leukemia, we move away from intensive chemo, but you have to be aware, very intensive chemo is highly successful. We cure 95% of the children, 90%. However, we have long-term sequelae. And second, these intensive regimens are not applicable in adults or even not in elderly patients at all. There, it's a change in paradigm. This is the first trial in adult pH-positive ALL, which is completely chemo-free. So the patients receive a little bit of corticosteroids, a tyrosine kinase inhibitor, and the B-specific antibody blinatumomab. And this all together in sequence leads to a very high complete remission rate. And what's very important, we avoid the deaths due to toxicity in induction, which goes up to 5 or even 10% in adults. It was only one patient. And then also patients got a transplant, but this mild induction and consolidation therapy led also to a very low treatment-related mortality rate. And so it's good for the to achieve a complete remission, to achieve a molecular remission, MRD negativity, which is now most imminent in ALL. And we have good long-term results. So I think we go to a very new era. And interestingly, not shown here, but there were just two recent publications that also the pediatricians think to substitute some of their chemotherapy by the B-specific antibody blinatumomab. And in two large randomized studies, they could show that it's much superior to chemo consolidation, much less toxicity and other side effects. And it's becoming now very soon frontline therapy. And this is only one drug. I mean, we have in addition, we have the antibody therapy with inotuzumab, anti-CD20. And we have the CAR T cells, which are explored in adults as in children. So this, I think, was the greatest progress apart from the other presentations.
Okay, great. Thank you. So this is the abstract. Was it in Philadelphia chromosome positive patients? But do I understand right? Are you saying that this could perhaps translate to other ALL patients?
Yes, we hope, but you know, only for B-lineage ALL patients, we have these antibodies available. And 25% of the adults are T acute lymphoblastic leukemia, and the results has not improved so far. I mean, the good group may have 60%, but the other patients relapse and fail. There was even there ASH abstract from Ribera showing the very, very poor outcome for T-ALL. There is no antibody therapy there. They're currently available. But again, researchers are working on CAR T cells against T cells, which is not so simple. But I think very soon you will see also a progress in this otherwise poor subtype of ALL. Two other abstracts dealt with the unfortunately with a complicated situation, which means extramedullary relapse, either somewhere in the body or CNS relapse. And blinatumomab is not very successful in preventing this extramedullary relapse. Neither or similar inotuzumab, so far only chimeric antigen receptor T cells are really active, going in the brain, can cure relapsed children with CNS disease. So this is a gap, and therefore we have to watch very carefully, and we have to do prophylactic intrathecal therapy to prevent this CNS relapse.
Yes, I think I remember reading that. It's one of the plans for the phase three. They're going to have more CNS prophylaxis. Is that correct?
I think if you have an adequate CNS prophylaxis without this without these immunotherapies, for instance, in our study, the German Multicenter trial, we have 2,800 patients and the relapse rate is only 1%. But we do intrathecal therapy, high-dose RAC, high-dose methotrexate, and in some cases also CNS irradiation. So it is possible to prevent, but immunotherapy is not the solution to substitute it. We have to be, as you just said, very careful, and we have to do something.
Brilliant, thank you. I also noted in the trial in the Philadelphia chromosome positive abstract, there was inferior responses in patients with the IKZF1+ genotype. So how common is that genotype? And do you think if this does become a standard of care, would it be a case of differentiating between those?
Very patients? Exactly what you are saying. This genetic abnormality is has an adverse impact in all the different ALL subtypes. And to be honest, we have so far no solution to overcome those patients with this aberration. Transplant would be a possibility, but we have no results. And the number of transplants in the study of GRD lymphoma is too small to decide. But there is no specific drug so far, and we are a little bit open and do not know what the optimal solution will be.
Brilliant, thank you. So Dr. Zeidan, do you have any thoughts on this as someone who does treat AL patients, either on this particular abstract or the concept of eliminating chemotherapy from treatment in general?
No, this has been an amazing progress, clearly, in Philadelphia positive ALL. You know, this used to be one of the most difficult diseases to treat, and almost always we take patients to transplant despite receiving a lot of chemotherapy for multiple years between induction, consolidation, and maintenance. And I think the introduction of chemo-free approaches have been quite exciting. We have seen this across a number of leukemias now, with starting basically with APL, in which chemotherapy-free approach with ATRA and arsenic has become the standard of care. And I do agree with Dr. Hotzels that we are going in the same direction of chemotherapy-free approach. I think the question in terms of what is exactly the backbone that goes with the TKI and which TKI, as was hinted, I think there is a question whether dasatinib or ponatinib is the best agent. There's clearly more potency with ponatinib, which covers more mutations, but there's also concern for increased risks. It seems like with dose management and dose reductions, this also can be managed. So in addition to the trial that was discussed, there was a presentation in ASCO, and I believe in EHA as well, of the MD Anderson trial with ponatinib and blinatumomab, which also seems to be showing very nice results. A lot of these are still single-arm phase 1/2 trials, so I think there will be a lot of interest in seeing what are the randomized data. But I can tell you, in countries where we have access to these drugs off trial, such as in the U.S., I actually often give my older patients steroids with TKI, and sometimes blinatumomab. I use it more often in the relapse setting because this is where the label is in the US. So I would give ponatinib and blinatumomab, but there is definitely more interest in moving these to the frontline setting as well. So I think a lot of exciting developments in this field.
Brilliant, thank you. So what about you, Dr. Zeidan? What's been your highlight from the EHA and ASCO conferences?
Yeah, so I think in terms of both for MDS and AML, I would start by saying that there has not been any practice-changing type of presentations in terms of what people do day-to-day, but there's definitely has been a number of, I think, interesting abstracts building up on the previous data that has been presented, especially from different agents that have been exciting. So if we start with MDS, especially the high-risk disease, the standard of care has been and continues to be a single agent hypomethylating agent, whether it's azacitidine or decitabine, while trying to take patients who are able to go to transplant, which generally is a minority of MDS patients because many of them are older and have multiple comorbidities. So that has been the paradigm since the approval of hypomethylating agents in the US since 2004 and in Europe, I believe, in 2009. But this looks like it's going to change also in the near future because we have reports on a number of combination-based therapies in which a drug is being added to hypomethylating agents. And we are starting to see more mature data from those trials. So we've seen updates of a trial in which patients with MDS were randomized to receive azacitidine versus azacitidine with povonedostat, which is a first-in-class NID8 activating enzyme inhibitor. The data has been presented more than once, and in this meeting here, there was an update about the rates of molecular clearance and MRD negativity that you can achieve with this regimen. So there was an increased rate with the combination for CR, but the survival did not seem to change. Of course, this is a phase two trial that, and there was a phase three trial that has completed accrual with this drug called the Panther study, which is expected to report in the near future. Another two agents that have been interesting in the MDS space were venetoclax. The phase two data, again, single arm study, of around 80 patients in the frontline setting. We have heard an update in this ASCO and actually EHA meeting as well, looking at some of the dose modifications because this regimen is myelosuppressive in AML and it seems to be the same way in MDS. So how do you adjust the dosing of the venetoclax and the azacitidine for those patients is an ongoing discussion that's also being explored in clinical trials. The data so far from this combination have been quite promising, and there is an ongoing phase three trial called the Verona trial. I presented in ASCO a trial in progress abstract, which is an abstract basically that describes the design of this trial. So Verona is a randomized double-blind phase three trial that's happening internationally. 500 patients will be accrued on the study, in which patients receive azacitidine with venetoclax versus azacitidine with placebo. The primary endpoint of this study will be a co-primary endpoint of overall survival and complete response. And the study is ongoing, and I'm hoping that we are going to have some results over the next 2 to 3 years where we can see for sure whether there is the same benefit that was seen in the single-arm early data is replicated in the randomized study. It's an amazing time where we have basically six randomized phase three trials happening at the same time for higher risk MDS. So I think it's a very interesting time to be for this field, and we're probably going to see a flux of drugs similar to what has happened in acute myeloid leukemia 3 or 4 years ago, where we had nothing aside from 7+3 for many, many years. And now we have 9 to 10 approvals in the last few years in the US for this disease subset.
Brilliant, thank you. So of those six phase three trials, the Verona study, I had a quick look at that one. It's I noticed it has both intermediate and higher risk on the inclusion exclusion criteria. What are some other inclusion and exclusion criteria for that particular trial?
Yeah, so basically the inclusion exclusion for this trial is pretty typical. So this trial is only for adult patients, which is quite typical, 18 years and older. The patients has to have should not have acute myeloid leukemia, meaning that the blast count has to be less than 20%. The trial does exclude people who have therapy-related MDS, and I have to say this is across a number of trials that the patients with therapy-related myeloid neoplasm get excluded, or patients who have MDS that arises from previous MPN or MDS-MPN overlap, or patients who have received prior therapy for their MDS, such as chemotherapy, or if they had lower risk disease, lenalidomide. So those subsets are excluded. I think it will be important, especially if the trial comes positive, to better understand the performance of the combination in those disease subsets.
Great, thank you. So that covers MDS. What about for AML? Were there any particular highlights for you at ASCO or EHA in terms of AML publications?
Yeah, and I think in AML also, as I alluded to, a large number of agents have been coming forward basically, which has been exciting because it's allowing more options for our patients. I think the way it's going in AML is a number of combination-based strategies in which double oral therapy. And again, along the lines of what Dr. Holzer was saying earlier, we could actually even arrive to a point where we can do chemo-free, completely oral approaches with AML, which is unheard of, I would say, or I probably could not be imagined a few years ago, because we now have oral hypomethylating agents, which people can, I guess, debate whether they are chemo or not. But for sure, we have IDH inhibitors, we have FLT3 inhibitors, we have venetoclax. All of these are targeted agents. And I think in terms of practice changing, we have not had anything that was practice changing, but there were the results, I think, that caught my attention, the IDENTIFY trial, which is the phase 3 trial that looked at the IDH2 inhibitor in inasidenib in patients with refractory relapsed AML who have the IDH2 mutation. So this drug was approved in the US based on the large phase 1 trial in which patients had around 20% complete response rate and around 40% overall response rate and some transfusion independence. This was clearly a single arm trial, but based on the benefit that was seen and the high unmet need for those patients, this drug was approved in the US, but there was no phase 3 data. So the phase 3 trial, the IDENTIFY, was just presented in this EHA meeting, and it actually was negative for the primary endpoint. So there was no difference in overall survival for these patients. So the patients were randomized to receive the inasidenib or what we call conventional care regimens, which at the discretion of the physician, the patient could receive azacitidine, could receive low-dose cytarabine or intermediate-dose cytarabine, or best supportive care. And the survival, I think, is along the lines of what you expect for this patient population. It was around 6 to 7 months, because in relapsed refractory AML, the survival tend to be quite poor. But there was no difference in the survival. And, you know, the authors have pointed out that there was an improvement in a number of secondary endpoints, such as event-free survival and time to treatment failure and complete responses, overall responses. So it does seem there is clinically meaningful benefits with the inasidenib, but the question is why do not this translate into overall survival prolongation on the trial? And the author suggested a number of possibilities that some of those patients who were randomized to the control arm could have received inasidenib subsequently, or they could have come off the study sooner so that they can receive inasidenib off trial. It's really tough to know without seeing the full manuscript, but I think in my mind, this study highlights that while a lot of progress has been achieved in AML, there is still a lot to be done. We are still not curing people with these drugs. Most patients still have very limited survival and low response rate. And I think the efforts should really focus on seeing how we can combine these drugs and sequence them in the way that maybe can transform the field into more like a multiple myeloma setting where the patients can live many years with the disease, but they would be continuously on some therapy or another probably in multiple combinations and oral-based therapies.
Great, thank you. So thinking about combinations, so for that trial of inosidenib, would you like to see any particular combinations studied in the future?
Yeah, so there are a number of those combinations that are actually being studied already. So there is ongoing studies looking at inosidenib with venetoclax. Also, the other IDH inhibitor, the IDH1 inhibitor, ivosidenib, is also being combined with venetoclax, all in a triplet combination with hypomethylating agents. I think with those combinations, we have to consider two things. One of them is we are walking a fine line between escalating the benefit to the patient, but also when you add a lot of these drugs, they can be quite myelosuppressive. And for those older patients or patients who have refractory disease, they might not necessarily be tolerated. We've already seen a hint of this in the combinations of the FLT3 inhibitors with venetoclax, where many of the what are called responses are actually reduction in the blast without count recovery. So I think a lot of work should be done to optimize the duration of those drugs. How do you overlap them in a way that makes clinical sense based on the preclinical synergy data, but also in terms of how patients are responding?
Brilliant, thank you. So again, thinking about the phase 3 study of inosidenib, do you think, I read that abstract and I noted that there were some subgroups that they analyzed where they did see an improvement in overall response. For example, those with MIDH2R172 mutations. And I think those that were eligible for lower intensity therapy. Do you think it would be worthwhile, or do you think we could see better results if we focused on those particular subgroups?
You are bringing up a very good point. So most of the mutations, as you mentioned, happen in specific locations, basically within the gene. I think the bigger picture question is that as we get more of this, what I call precision medicine approach, is the care is becoming actually more individualized. And the physicians don't only look, oh, this patient has an IDH1 or IDH2 mutation, but they also need to look at the type of the mutation, at the location of the mutation, at the variable allele frequency, how common is the mutation. And as you can imagine, for an oncologist who deals with all types of tumors, and this is happening across the entire cancer paradigm, it's not an easy job to do. So I think we need to have a better understanding of like which are the disease subset that the patient can benefit the most. So this is, I think, is something that's going to be analyzed very carefully in the trial to try to identify subsets that might have improvement in survival. Of course, with the understanding that any kind of post hoc analysis sometimes could be statistically challenging to interpret. So we have to keep that in mind as well.
Of course. Dr. Holzer, what do you think for ALL? Do you think we could see more sort of personalization of care in ALL in the future?
I think, yes, we will. We are already on the way to move to personalized. However, one has to also to say critically, in the beginning, our induction consolidation therapy is always identical. If you look to the large childhood trials and adult ALL trials, we start with a identical induction consolidation, and then we move to the special subgroups. What I did not mention, and neither you, is stem cell transplantation is still the curative approach in AML and ALL. And I think we should not forget that one of the aims is also to reduce the number of transplants because of long-term toxicity and acute toxicity. So apart from the subspecialty therapy, we should not lose this aim in mind. You know?
So brilliant. Thank you both so much for joining us today. It's been really great to hear about your conference highlights and your thoughts on the general state of of play in AML, ALL and MDS at the moment. Thank you for joining us.
So that brings us to the end of today's episode. To recap on the key points we discussed, for the first time, chemotherapy-free regimens are on the horizon for adult ALL patients, while for MDS, six ongoing phase 3 trials offer promise for an influx of novel therapy options in the near future. For AML, although the phase 3 of enasidenib did not meet its primary endpoint, this may highlight the importance of combination-based strategies to improve survival rates in these patients. We'll be back in 2 weeks' time with the final episode where we'll hear from another expert, Dr. Naval Daver, about his ASCO and EHA conference highlights. In the meantime, you can also find free, accredited, continuing medical education modules on our website, onkip.com, and you can find a link in this in the episode notes. And if you're a Twitter fan, our handle is @onckip. Thank you for listening, and until next time.